From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, can a gay Latina veteran sheriff running for governor of Texas flip the state blue?
I'm being challenged from all areas. They're challenging me. So are the people who don't like Latinos. So are the people who don't like lesbians. So are the people who don't like strong women. I get challenged from everywhere.
We follow Lupe Valdez on the campaign trail in Texas. And we talk about one controversial candidate running for governor in Kansas and how he might be profiting off of anti-immigration policies.
It's not like they spent $9 million and they were like, oh, well. Like, they spent $9 million and that meant that they couldn't move forward with road construction.
Plus, the new documentary, The Sentence. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. It is the end of August, and Latino USA producer Maggie Freeling and I are in Odessa, in the heart of West Texas.
Here, take my jacket.
We're with the Democratic candidate for governor of Texas. Her name is Sheriff Lupe Valdez, and we're following her on the campaign trail. Right now, we're with her at a Mexican restaurant, and she's trying to dish out enchiladas.
An enchilada's trying to run away.
It's 2 months until Election Day, and today, Sheriff Valdez is helping a church feed the homeless.
Are you helping us?
Of course.
All right.
Sheriff, let's get you an apron.
Okay. Sheriff Valdez is a short little lady, and once the enchiladas are plated up, she tries to carry the big tray of food as her campaign staff looks on nervously.
I got it, I got it. Put your hands up.
Water was just spilt, and it's really wet and slippery out there. Really don't think it's
the man that you hear repeatedly trying to wrangle the sheriff is one of her campaign staffers. His name is Juan Bautista Dominguez.
Let's bring it back, Sheriff. Sheriff.
And wrangling the sheriff is something Juan and other staffers have gotten used to because, well, she's a pretty independent woman, to say the least.
Right. Being part of the Lupe Valdez for governor team is like being part of a small, loving family trying to do what's best for their stubborn grandma.
She just turned 71, by the way.
You got call time.
Can I finish my salad?
But even though she might seem quirky or carefree, Lupe Valdez is also highly accomplished and focused. Right now, she's on a mission to flip the Texas governor's seat blue for the first time in nearly 30 years. And if she does, she'll be the first openly gay and Latina governor of the state of Texas. That is, if she can get Latino voters to turn out for her. And that's the hard part. Today, we're going to start our show trying to answer this question. Can a gay Latina Democrat appeal to voters across all of Texas? It's super early in the morning in El Paso, and Latino USA producer Maggie Freeling and I are in a parking lot.
What time is it?
6:32 in El Paso.
Where's the sheriff?
She is having coffee.
Oh, boy, I guess we should go.
We're meeting the Lupe Valdez for Governor caravan at a Starbucks.
Yes, sir.
This is Miss Hinojosa.
Hi, ¿cómo está?
How are you? Hi, nice to meet you.
We're going to go with them on the Midland-Odessa leg of their campaign trip through West Texas.
While the sheriff's staff is loading up the truck, she sits down to talk with us. She's antsy and energetic, even this early.
I have trouble sitting here not helping, because I want to get out there and help.
Help him do what?
Load. The truck, you know, we put all that stuff in and out. Usually I put on some yucky clothes first and then change into other clothes. But I have no idea what the schedule is like today, so just dress to be ready to whatever.
She's wearing white dress pants, a white collared shirt, a peachy pink blazer, and to top off the look, black running sneakers.
Is this typical for you, Sheriff?
No.
She's more comfortable in casual clothes.
Sheriff Valdez is sometimes described as a salt of the earth type of person. She's not a big policy wonk. She relies more on her background to appeal to voters. And she has a campaign video about it.
Every day she'd go into the bathroom before class to clean her shoes. It might seem like a small thing, but she was the only girl who came from a place that had no streets or sidewalks, just dirt and mud.
Lupe Valdez was born into a Mexican-American family of migrant farm workers. She was raised in a poor area of San Antonio. The youngest of eight children, she paid her way through college, eventually getting a master's degree in criminology and criminal justice.
Most of her brothers and sisters didn't even finish school because the family followed the crops.
After that, she joined the Army National Guard and eventually became a senior federal agent at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, right when it was formed, at times working undercover.
Later to South America, where she gathered intelligence on drug trafficking.
She retired from Homeland Security to run for sheriff of Dallas County. At the time, one of the largest police departments in the country. And she won, becoming the first openly gay Latina sheriff in the United States. She spent over 12 years in that position.
And that was no small thing.
And so, at age 70, Lupe Valdez says she saw an opportunity to continue to serve Texas. She resigned as sheriff
so she can run for governor of Texas.
And with this announcement, Sheriff Lupe Valdez, she instantly becomes the Democratic frontrunner with this decision, although she will become the seventh Democrat to announce. And tomorrow, Andrew White, the son of former Texas Governor Mark White, is also
after a tight primary race back in May, Sheriff Valdez beat challenger Andrew White, whose father was governor in the 1980s.
Valdez, celebrating victory.
And now, Lupe Valdez is facing the incumbent Republican governor of Texas, Greg Abbott,
who is seeking re-election.
And he has fairly high approval ratings.
We reached out multiple times to the governor's office for an interview, but we have not heard back. And despite Abbott's popularity, Sheriff Valdez is campaigning on the message that the Republicans who run Texas care more about special interests than people.
So what's your motivation today?
The same as it is every day. The everyday Texan has not been hurt in Texas.
And she considers herself the person who will give these people a voice because she says she herself is an everyday Texan, starting with, well, her very recognizable pickup truck.
That's so Texas.
This is my Tacoma truck, Toyota Tacoma truck, and it's got my name for governor and a picture.
You're kind of plastered on the back of your truck right there.
Just a section. I mean, it's not wrapped all the way around.
Instead of being carted around in a luxury campaign bus, she's putting on the miles in her own personal vehicle with her name and photo on the back.
It's a little dangerous because if people don't like you, you know, we're going up to some parts that a Hispanic person may not be as well liked.
You ever gotten the finger?
Yeah. Yeah. But it probably wasn't for this. It was probably for our driving.
So we got in the car and hoped their driving wasn't that bad.
Good, for how long? How many hours are we going to be in the car?
Five hours.
Is that all?
Once we're all aboard, we hit the campaign trail.
I'm going to a function.
And on the way, we chat with one of the sheriff's campaign staffers. Her name is Yolitzma Aguirre.
We're heading out to what most folks know as West Texas, which is Odessa, Midland, Big Spring.
Yolitzma tells us that she joined Sheriff Valdez's campaign right after Donald Trump was elected. She felt obligated to get politically active. So when she found out Sheriff Valdez was running for governor in her home state of Texas,
I just died a thousand deaths. I was just like, oh my God, yes, I love her. I often tell people, for me, after Selena, there hasn't been anyone that has impacted my life that I can see myself in, like a woman of color. You know, she's brown like me. She speaks Spanish and English like me. She reflects to so many pockets of voters. You know, she's just like us. The other day, a tree branch fell. There she was with a chainsaw, cutting it up so that it wouldn't get in the way of pedestrians. And yeah, she's one of us. I definitely feel we now have a candidate that is of the people.
And if Sheriff Valdez wins, she'll help fulfill a longtime dream of the Democrats to turn Texas blue.
For decades, the Texas governor's seat was solidly Democrat. There were Democratic governors almost every year since it became a state in 1845 all the way through the 1970s. 38 Democrats, 2 Republicans.
Of course, the parties used to be very different back then.
Then in 1979, the state flipped back and forth, blue to red, until 1995, when George W. Bush took office as governor. And since then, Texas has voted consistently Republican for both state and national elections. Republicans currently control the state Senate and the state House of Representatives.
Right. And so, Maria, that's why today many people feel a Democrat doesn't have a chance, because Texas has been deep red for over 20 years.
There have been challengers, though.
Wendy Davis gave it a good shot. She was a Democratic Texas senator who became famous after nearly a half a day filibuster to block an anti-abortion bill.
Texas state senator that everyone is talking about, Wendy Davis, a Democrat, took a stand against a bill restricting abortions in the state.
She ran for governor in last election cycle and lost to Governor Abbott by a 20-point margin.
Right. So if a Democratic darling like Wendy Davis couldn't win in the state of Texas, what really are the chances for Sheriff Valdez?
Well,
remember, she beat 7 people to make it to the runoff, and she won in the runoff. So we're consistent in victory.
In fact, even when Lupe Valdez ran for sheriff of Dallas, she was also the underdog. But she won, and won again, 4 times in a row.
So she's got a track record of breaking barriers and shattering those glass ceilings.
And some analysts say Texas really could turn blue. The state is getting younger and browner. Latinos are expected to become the majority of Texans by 2022. And while Latinos in Texas are a little more conservative than elsewhere in the nation, they tend to favor Democrats.
In fact, some experts argue in the next presidential election, Texas will be a toss-up state. And so all this brings us to one of the sheriff's biggest talking points.
Texas is not a red state. It's a non-voting state. If the people would vote, we would win.
She's right about the non-voting part. The state has one of the lowest voter participation rates in the country, and many of those non-voters are Latinos. Texas has the second largest eligible population of Latino voters nationally, yet only 27% say they will absolutely vote in the midterm election, compared to 65% for non-Hispanic whites. And for the sheriff to win, she needs to get Latino voters out to the polls, especially first-time Latino voters. And she thinks she can do it.
If you give them something to vote for, something they identify with, there's a better possibility that they'll come out to vote.
And she's even going around registering Latino voters one at a time.
Oh, they didn't put gas in your car.
I gotta get gas.
Right. And we saw this for ourselves when we stopped along I-10 to get gas and the sheriff started chatting up the cashier.
Are you able to vote? Are you a U.S. citizen?
Yeah.
The cashier's name is Tessie Ramirez.
I'm going to bring you a registration form.
And it turns out she's an unregistered potential voter.
Send it in.
Are you going to register now?
Yeah.
So maybe a +1 for the sheriff?
Well, you know, every vote counts, right?
Right. So after this, we hop in the car, head to the next campaign event. We stop for lunch.
Chopped tuna salad.
Go through an immigration checkpoint.
How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
All your citizens?
Yes, sir.
You guys drive safe. Have a good day.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
And arrive at the Mexican restaurant in Odessa. Cameras and reporters are waiting for the sheriff when we arrive.
Everyday Texans are struggling.
Mostly she talks about economic issues, things like college affordability and health care. And she often brings up her own background as the child of poor migrant workers to help her message resonate.
I know what it is to try and decide between a doctor or the rent.
We step away and start chatting with some of the people who are at the event. We walk over to an elderly trio and I ask them, why do they like Sheriff Valdez?
She has a lot of great qualities, and women can do these things.
This is Joan Hurd. She's here with her friend Marian Atkins Reedy. They're both lifelong Democrats in their 70s and 80s. And like the sheriff, they tell us there's more Democrats in Texas than you might think. And they share a laugh with her about this.
So they're coming out of the closet.
That's what we say, the closet yes, Democrats.
They'll say stuff like, wow, I didn't know there was more Democrats around here.
But it was a little surprising to find that in a predominantly Latino city like Odessa, that the people who came out to support her are the longtime older white Democrats.
Not the first-time Latino voters she needs to turn out if she wants to win.
And at her next campaign event, this problem seems to get worse. That's coming up. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org. And FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Latino USA producer Maggie Freeling and I are following Sheriff Lupe Valdez. She's the Democratic candidate for governor of Texas, and we're with her on the campaign trail.
And after stopping in Odessa, we drove about an hour northeast to Howard College in Big Spring, Texas, another majority Latino city.
We walk into an air-conditioned room at the college, and we wait for the Howard County Democrats to announce that Sheriff Valdez is their guest.
But as they're listing off her credentials, the sheriff isn't really paying attention. Instead, she leans over to us and points to a guy in the corner with a camera.
That's my Greg Abbott tracker.
What?
That's my Greg Abbott tracker. He's paid by Greg Abbott to track me everywhere I go and take my speeches. At first, people started throwing him out, and then I said, no, no, no. You know, the guy's just doing a job. Yeah? Just, we're Democrats. We're decent.
Hi.
Suddenly, she's called up to the stage. She's caught a little bit off guard as she heads up to the podium, and we're watching her walk up, and then we kind of get a chance to look at who is in the room.
Right. So if up until this point, it seems like Lupe Valdez is the candidate who has what it takes to deliver Texas to the Democrats, the candidate who is of the people and for the people, law enforcement, LGBTQ, POC, working class, well, this is where that notion hits a bump in the road. There's about 35 people in the room we're in, and we notice the potentially devastating campaign flaw. Young people, specifically the lack thereof.
I'm not really sure. We're trying to get them out.
This is Reina Cisneros, the Howard County Democratic chair. And looking around the room, there are no young people here at all. And we are at a college. There are students everywhere. School is in session.
There's actually a room full of college students next door to us in the cafeteria eating lunch.
I don't think they're going to turn out as much as the older individuals. I mean, I think that's kind of our problem, is how do we get them to turn out? And I'm really not sure what the answer is or what the solution is.
And we're not the only ones who notice this.
A September Quinnipiac poll has Sheriff Valdez's favorability rating among young people 10 points lower than Governor Abbott's.
Younger voters are important for Democrats to win in any state. And one-third of eligible Latino voters in Texas are ages 18 to 29.
That's a large portion of Latino voters in a state where the Latino vote is key. But here we are at a college where nearly half of the students are Latinos and Latinas, and none of them are at this event. So there are a few things that could be contributing to what seems to be a lack of enthusiasm for Valdez, particularly from young voters. The first problem the sheriff has is name recognition. Not enough people know who she is.
And part of this is advertising, and that comes down to money, which the sheriff has a lot less of than her opponent. Governor Abbott has raised over $65 million in campaign funds compared to the sheriff's less than half a million.
But there's something else at play here, something that goes deeper into Lupe Valdez as a candidate.
During the Democratic primary, Jolt Texas, a political mobilization group for young Latinos, didn't endorse the sheriff. They endorsed her rival, Andrew White. They said it was because of her record as sheriff of Dallas. They pointed out that during her tenure, Sheriff Valdez cooperated with federal immigration authorities by holding immigrants in her jail cells when requested and handing them over to ICE.
We spoke with Antonio Arellano from Jolt about his concerns, and he said he was disappointed when the sheriff didn't have a good answer about this at a forum aimed at young Latino voters in April.
So we wanted to hear her kind of take accountability for her record, and she just didn't. We would like to see her take more of a bold and fearless stance.
The New York Times reported that one of the students who was in the audience the day of the forum said, quote, "You were a Latina when you were helping deport people, so why should I trust you now?"
The sheriff told us she didn't have a choice. She was required by law to cooperate with ICE. And in fairness, she did famously go head-to-head with Governor Abbott in 2015. She was refusing to honor ICE requests to hold people who were accused of minor offenses. Since Andrew White lost the Democratic primary, Jolt is now endorsing her for governor. But Antonio says,
going forward, we would want to see an action plan that protects undocumented immigrants.
I asked Sheriff Valdez whether she will take on what some of the younger progressives want her to do to protect undocumented immigrants. Things like fighting to shut down detention centers and to stop deportations.
Are you prepared to go to that
place? I am prepared to go that place, but I don't have that power. This is a federal issue.
You could make a statement. What would be your statement?
No, I wouldn't just make a statement. I take action. Action can be taken on SB4. SB4 is a cruel bill and is affecting the undocumented. That is something I can do.
What she's talking about is the ban in Texas on so-called sanctuary cities. It's a law called SB4, and it was signed by Governor Abbott last year.
Hi, I'm Governor Greg Abbott.
He broadcast the moment in a Facebook Live video.
As I sign a law that will ban sanctuary cities in Texas.
The law essentially forces local police to work with federal immigration officials, and it allows police to ask people they stop for their papers.
It ensures that law enforcement officers in Texas can and will cooperate with ICE.
Sheriff Valdez opposes the law and has made it one of the biggest issues of her campaign. She also supports allowing undocumented immigrants to pay in-state tuition.
But then we ask her about another policy that many young progressives are pushing for.
Is abolish ICE part of your platform?
ICE needs to be reformed.
You're not saying abolish.
The original task of ICE was to keep people out who would do harm. They've gone away from that, and it needs to be reformed. But do you honestly want nobody to make sure that another attack on a major city is not going to happen? Do you honestly just want him to let him come in and do an attack on the cities?
Sounds a little Republican what you're saying right there.
No, it doesn't. It sounds like we want to protect our country.
And so maybe some Republicans might like this strong borders national security rhetoric. Maybe she can make up for the lack of enthusiasm of some young Democrats by winning over some Republicans. But that's not going to be so easy given how polarized the parties are these days. When we were in Odessa, we met a Republican voter at the Mexican restaurant who told us,
"Tell me you're a Democrat, I know where you're at and where you stand, and that is not where I stand."
Period, point blank. So you're like, "Hi, nice to see you. I don't even want to hear what you have to say."
Well, one of the big reasons is because Democrats are going so hard socialist. They're unabashed now. It's just that's what big government, let's get raise the taxes so we can take from the rich and give it to the poor.
So here lies the crux of the problem for Sheriff Valdez. Her staff believes that her unique story of being the first gay Latina sheriff in the country will reach a broad range of Texans. But it could end up having the opposite effect and turn off people from both sides. Even the largest police union of Texas is endorsing Governor Abbott.
I'm being challenged from all areas. They're challenging me. So are the people who don't like Latinos. So are the people who don't like lesbians. So are the people who don't like strong women. I get challenged from everywhere.
And so even if voters do come out for her en masse, she also faces systemic challenges. In Texas, voter suppression is a big issue. According to the ACLU, Texas voter ID laws disproportionately affect people of color, a large part of Sheriff Valdez's base.
So we're back in the car, taking all of this into consideration as we're driving to the final stop for the day in Midland, Texas. And I asked the sheriff,
"There are people who also say, look, Wendy Davis tried to do this. She was something of an American political hero for a moment there. She could not win the governorship. What makes you think you can do this?"
Okay. I came from the poorest zip code in San Antonio to now the nominee for the governor of Texas. That's a long ways to come. And guess what? The little child in the barrio, in the colonia, in the ghetto, in rural Texas can have that same opportunity. There was an LA reporter who came over here right almost at the beginning. And the title of her piece was Lupe Valdez, Even If She Loses, Texas Wins.
Lupe Valdez very well might lose this election. She's down 20 points. The sheriff herself says it's an uphill battle.
But on the other hand,
I am so glad to see you here.
The sheriff recently went on a big city tour, attending festivals and concerts, including one in Dallas with popular Senate hopeful Beto O'Rourke and popular rock band Spoon. And she was speaking to crowds of people there.
Thank you, thank you. Lupe Valdez, ladies and gentlemen.
And the Pew Research Center says that national voter enthusiasm this election cycle is at the highest level during any midterm in more than two decades, especially for Democratic voters. So who knows? Maybe there's still a chance the polls are underestimating her and that Lupe Valdez will surprise everyone and win. Or maybe the Democratic dream of turning Texas blue will have to wait for another election. My thanks to Maggie Freeling for reporting that story with me. Now we turn from the election for the governor's seat in Texas to the governor's seat in Kansas. Kris Kobach is running on the Republican ticket for governor there.
Why do I fight so hard for Kansas? That's easy.
Look at the owl we knit.
This is Matilda.
Kris Kobach is running on the Republican ticket for governor of Kansas.
I want my girls to grow up in a Kansas that's safe from crime and terrorism, that doesn't tax its citizens to death, and that has a...
Currently, he's the Secretary of State of Kansas. And if his name sounds familiar, it might be because in recent years, Kobach's been at the forefront of developing restrictive anti-immigrant policies in the United States. Kobach was involved with drafting Arizona's infamous SB 1070, better known as the Show Me Your Papers law, as well as a similar law in Alabama. Kobach's resume also includes helping to craft and defend anti-immigrant ordinances for a number of towns across the country. An investigation co-published by ProPublica and the Kansas City Star found that Kobach made a lot of money doing this, but the towns that hired him often didn't fare so well. I'm joined by ProPublica journalist Jessica Huseman to talk about her investigation. So where did your kind of interest in Kris Kobach, where did your interest begin?
I started covering elections right before the 2016 election, and he was sort of a minor player in the 2016 election in that he was one of those people that talked a lot about voter fraud, but he wasn't that big of a deal. And then as soon as he became the commissioner for Trump's Voter Fraud Commission, I started paying very close attention to him.
President Trump launching a new commission on election integrity. The move coming after President Trump raised questions about widespread voter fraud in the 2016 election.
He is a person that just has very extreme ideas about the way voting should work, who should be able to vote, and I realize that the vast majority of his views on voting stem from his views on immigration.
It's a no-brainer. If you really want to create jobs for Americans, we need to start aggressively enforcing our immigration laws and looking after our own citizens first.
So tell us a little bit about Kris Kobach and his background. Like, where is it that he starts getting these hardline views on immigration?
Kris Kobach grew up in Topeka. He was valedictorian of his high school class and went to Harvard. And while he was at Harvard, he studied under a professor who had very extreme ideas on democracy.
I'm going to take a wild guess and say that that professor is Samuel Huntington.
It is Samuel Huntington. He thinks that, I think he calls it the Latinoization of America, and he says that that's going to lead to like a downfall of American culture. And that person was Kris Kobach's mentor at Harvard.
So how does it happen when you're looking into the background of Kris Kobach that you start making some connections around anti-immigrant theoretical issues and Kris Kobach actually making money off of some of the policies that he ends up basically creating, supporting?
Right. So his first real job with government was after George W. Bush got elected, he joined the Department of Justice. And so he leaves the DOJ and goes to work for a immigration group called the Federation for American Immigration Reform.
That would be FAIR.
FAIR, which is a very extreme group that advocates for limits on immigration and for radical alterations to refugee policies, among other things.
Maybe it's time to phase down immigration so we can phase Americans back in. Paid for by Federation for American Immigration Reform.
And so he went to work for them as an attorney, but he leaves there to become Secretary of State for Kansas. But during this whole time, he is also trying cases across the country for towns who want very radical immigration ordinances for their individual town.
Election day was a victory in Farmers Branch for supporters of Ordinance 2903, the law that requires possible tenants to prove U.S. citizenship.
Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Farmers Branch, Texas, Fremont, Nebraska, and Valley Park, Missouri.
As of today, anyone renting a house or apartment in Fremont must pay $5 for an occupancy permit, and only people in the country legally can get one.
People are moving out and packing up and leaving, and it's having the desired effect that we wanted it to have.
Usually the ordinances were already on the books, and he helped them refine them and then defend them in court once they were sued. We have traced back all of the money that these cities directly paid Kris Kobach.
As a lawyer.
As a lawyer. So over a decade, we know that he made at least $800,000. These are all small towns whose demographics were shifting, and in some cases, not even for real. Like in Valley Park, Missouri, I think the Hispanic population went from like 1 to 3%, and that was enough to create this anti-immigration sentiment. What Kris Kobach did, in the opinion of the local people that we've talked to there who ended up sort of paying this person to do this work, was capitalize on that existing sentiment. For example, in Valley Park, the law technically was championed. He technically won in Valley Park in this like very narrow way. So the law in Valley Parks is technically on the books, but the people who are there have told us, one, they've never enforced it, and two, they regret doing it. And so he took that, which is not that big of a win, went to Farmers Branch and went to a couple of other places and said, look what I did for Valley Park. I can do that for you too. And then he used that win to create confidence in these towns, or at least the appearance of confidence, and use that to sort of plow forward. So we know, for example, that he went to Farmers Branch, Texas, and said, I did this in Valley Park, let's keep going. There was internal disagreement within the city council about whether they should keep going, whether it was worth the money. And he said, no, I can do the same thing for you as I did for Valley Park. And so they pressed forward, ended up spending more than $9 million, and their law was entirely struck down. Like, we're not talking about towns the size of Dallas or the size of New York City. It's not like they spent $9 million and they were like, oh, well. Like, they spent $9 million and that meant that they couldn't move forward with road construction. And so this was actually a material sacrifice on the part of these towns. The only person who appears to have really benefited from this is Kris Kobach.
So if you think now about, you know, that strategy— mm-hmm. earlier to what's happening in the United States right now. You know, what is the larger narrative that you see that's at play here in this moment in the United States when we have Donald Trump in the White House and directing a kind of particular perspective on policies regarding immigration?
You know, I think that prior to Trump getting elected and prior to Trump being as hardline on immigration as he has been, it was really easy to dismiss people like Kris Kobach. But now, those elements of the Republican Party are leading the country, and he has a much more impactful voice than he otherwise would. I think that we can learn from what he has told us he believes in. I think that it is a sign that radical elements of our country have sort of taken a much larger role, and we can no longer dismiss them.
Jessica, thank you so much for all of your reporting and for joining us on Latino USA.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Jessica Huseman is a journalist at ProPublica who covers national politics and civil rights. We did reach out to the Kris Kobach campaign for comment on the allegations in the ProPublica investigation, but we didn't hear back. Kobach told ProPublica, quote, I believe in these cities and these ordinances and what they're doing. And so if there was some way I could help them, I did. Coming up on Latino USA, we talk to the creators of the new HBO documentary, The Sentence.
Conspiracy is knowledge. Any knowledge that you have of a crime, you can be charged with that crime.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is available at jkcf.org. And the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, guided by the belief that the arts and humanities are essential to the well-being of diverse and democratic societies. Learn more at Mellon.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. 11 years ago, Cindy Shank got a knock at the door. It was the police.
It was just the eeriest knock. I mean, It woke me up out of a dead sleep. Cindy jumped up. And later she told me she knew. She knew the minute she heard that door knock. I said, who would be knocking on the door at, you know, 6:30, 6:45 in the morning, something like that, 7 o'clock. I can't quite remember exactly. And she didn't say a word. She got up, grabbed the girls, you know, and went in her room and just was hugging them.
Cindy is a Mexican-American mother of three, and she was being arrested for the crimes of her ex-boyfriend, a drug dealer, even though he'd been dead for 6 years. The police charged Cindy for having lived in the same house as her ex-boyfriend when he broke the law. She received a 15-year mandatory sentence for conspiracy.
Conspiracy is knowledge. Any knowledge that you have of a crime, you can be charged for that crime. So basically, I lived in the home. Any crimes that he committed while we lived together, I was charged with.
Cindy's story isn't unique. It's part of something called the girlfriend problem. It's a side effect of sentencing laws where women end up serving time for the drug crimes of their significant others, even though they had little to do with those crimes. Filmmaker Rudy Valdez turned his sister Cindy's experience in prison into a documentary film called The Sentence. It just premiered on HBO. And the film looks at the impact of Cindy's time in prison on her and her family, and also her fight for early release. I'm joined now by both Cindy and her brother Rudy to talk about the film and life during and after incarceration. So, Cindy, what was your reaction at the very beginning? So you just get sentenced to 15 years and your brother's like, hey, can we make a documentary about this? I mean, did you kind of want to kill him at that point?
Well, it wasn't a documentary when he started to film. Initially, it was just he was taking videos of the girls for me. So when I came home, I could one day watch them run and play and, you know, be little girls because I was missing all those things. And so it wasn't until a few years later that he was like, hey, you know, I think this could be a documentary. I really want to tell your story. And by then I had already met, you know, so many women whose story was just like mine. And I understood that nobody knew what was really going on. And I wanted to share the story. I thought it was very important. I still think it's so important. It was a devastating thing to happen to our family, you know, not just to me. It happened to my mom, my dad, you know, my daughters. It was hard for them, you know, throughout this whole process. So it was an easy decision to say, yes, brother, share our story. Like, it was almost my way of, you know, screaming to the world what was happening.
There are a lot of things in this country that are filled with shame that we don't talk about. One of those issues is incarceration. And I really do appreciate the fact that this is something that most people never want to reveal. And you, your whole family was like, we're going to take this public.
I think shame is a great word to bring up here because one of the layers and one of the overall themes that I wanted to bring about in this film was shame and changing that stigma of A, being an incarcerated individual and what that meant, and also being the family of an incarcerated individual and what that meant, and really letting people look at what the true ramifications were so that we could possibly put a little bit of that shame on the system.
So, Cindy, there's a point in the film, early in your sentence, where you're talking to your then-husband, and you basically say, like, look, I'm trying to hold it together here. I'm not telling you how bad it is because I don't want you guys to know.
And I just don't want to tell you guys everything because I don't want you guys to be, you know, upset or worried or anything, but it's so hard.
What is it to be a woman in a prison? What didn't you want to tell that you can tell now?
I mean, there's a lot of things. We can go on and on. I mean, I never felt safe. I mean, they were all male guards. There were always people who were needing a lot of mental health. It was a very heightened emotional place to be. So you couldn't say something to somebody without wondering how they were going to react. They weren't bad people, but they were put in bad situations. And emotions ran high.
I mean, and I'm figuring that there are some things that Cindy isn't saying right about now.
You're right. Like, she kept a lot of that from us throughout the incarceration. And, you know, a lot of people will credit the family for being so strong and sticking by her throughout this entire process. But, you know, in so many ways, Cindy was the strongest person throughout this process. You know, she was dealing with something on her own.
You know, you get this sense that there is an intention to keep families separated. Like, it's not enough that you're going to just be in prison, but we're going to move you so far away from your family that it's hard to see each other. Because you first started out in a prison that was in Beacon, New York, you know, somewhat close to where your family was. But then suddenly you're moved to Florida.
I'm in a federal prison camp in Colman, Florida. It's 2011. The women's prison I was at in Beacon, they closed. I got moved here with 40 other women. I'm farthest from the girls. I mean, I'm seeing them like every 6 weeks. Now I'm not going to be able to see them at all.
I mean, it's really something to see kind of how the state gets between a family.
Yeah, I think it's just set up that way. You know, there has to be some rhyme or reason. They tell you they're going to keep you within so many, you know, 100 miles. I think it's within 500 miles of your family. But that, what is 500 miles to a family who has to travel and, you know, work and take time off? And, you know, that's, it's impossible to keep some type of regular connection. And then you're only allowed, you know, 300 minutes a month. So 15-minute calls, and it's set up to keep you separated. It's set up to keep you apart. So that was one of the things that I had to be very mindful of, keeping that connection the best that I could, trying to be present with them. That's why I was always, like, making them things or writing them, calling them, as, you know, every minute was for them. I'd spare, like, 10 minutes a month for maybe my other family members if they were lucky, you know. But just doing anything I could to fight for that connection.
So you only had 300 minutes a month?
Per month, correct. And the phone calls were automatically cut off at 15 minutes. And at 2 minutes, there was a beep, beep, beep. And you could literally, my daughters, when they would hear that beep, they'd panic. They'd panic. No, Mom. No, Mom. No, Mom. Mom, just please, like... And to hear that, and you're just telling them, you know, no, baby, I love you. You know, just trying to fit as much into that moment, into that last 2 minutes, and it just for it to hang up. It's devastating. It truly is for me and for them.
This call is from a federal prison.
Hello?
Rudy, I got it. Rudy, what? I got it.
What?
Let's go in the car. No, I want to tell you something. Something happened.
Yes.
Cindy's coming home. Cindy's coming home.
Today?
No, March 21st. It's in the news. Oh. She made Clemens.
You know, when the call comes in and you say, I got it, in the film, I was like... The last thing I was expecting was clemency. I was like...
So was I, the last thing.
Yeah, I mean, the way it just was, it was like a miracle. And I just figured that the end of the film was when you somehow got out on good behavior. And so I was completely taken by the fact that the clemency thing actually happened.
Yeah.
Can you tell, like, how did you get a call? Did they, what happened?
Yeah, I got a call. I was actually in county jail. I was being transferred to yet another prison when I got a phone call. And the guard knocks on the glass and says, you got a call. And when you get those calls, you don't ever want to call in prison. That's the first thing. You never want to receive a call.
I was just saying, who receives a call in
nobody,
prison?
Nobody, nobody. So
it's a bad thing to receive? Oh, because it means somebody died?
Yes. Something bad. That's 99.9% of the time. That's what it means.
So you thought?
I didn't know. So I went ahead and walked out, and she handed me the phone. And all I heard was, Cindy, it's Tatiana. And all she got out was, congratulations. And I screamed from the top of my lungs. I just fell to my knees and was just screaming, thank you, thank you. I hand the phone back to the officer and I scream, I got clemency!
And just finally, before I let you go, Cindy, you actually said something to me in our offices that I'd like for you to repeat, because I hadn't really heard that a lot. You were talking about actually listening to Latino USA when you were in prison.
Yeah, that was one of my lifelines. And to many, many people on the inside, NPR and Latino USA, especially for me, because it helped keep me connected to my roots, being informed what was going on. And your voice, you sounded like my mom. So, you know, you go into that Spanish English, that Spanglish that I love so much. And, you know, it was a lifeline for me. And I just wanted to say thank you because it meant everything.
I will say, Cindy, you know, she would call me from time to time and say, I need, you know, a little extra money for this or this. But there was one time in particular she called me with a little bit more desperation in her voice than normal. And she said, my radio broke. And I was like, what? Like, my headphones don't work. And I was like, okay, well, I don't have a lot of cash right now, but I'll send it to you. She was like, you don't understand. I need my NPR. Like, she was like,
dead
I
serious.
Need that.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, I'll get it to you as soon as possible. Like, she was like, I need it. I need it.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's
exactly
the desperation. Because it's true. It's like this connection. It's lifeline. It's something that's reaching inside those walls that nothing else can penetrate.
Okay, so here's your chance, Cindy. What do you want to say to all the women who are listening to Latino USA who are behind bars?
That I love you and that somebody's fighting for you and that please hang on and just have hope and never give up and love your children. Reach out as much as you can and have that connection, fight for that connection and just know that we're trying, we're fighting and we won't give up and we won't stop fighting.
Cindy and Rudy, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
The Sentence is a new documentary by Rudy Valdez, and it's available now on HBO. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, Sayer Quevedo, and Maya Cueva, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Fact-checking this week by Jennifer Velez. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
This episode of NPR's Latino USA was made possible with support from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Winecoat Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
It's the end of August in the heart of West Texas. Former sheriff, enchiladas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, celebrating 70 years of serving the public. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/70. And the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. This is NPR.